I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians.
So I do want to talk about something that does make me happy, because there's a lot of, I mean, we live in a target-rich environment for things that make you angry, and I got something for Christmas that I haven't talked about, I don't think, with either of you guys yet.
Is it a puppy?
No, oh. I think I would. I definitely would have mentioned a puppy. There's no way I could stay silent about a puppy.
I think that would have been hard to, yeah, that would have been hard to keep.
Oh, if you see how many pictures I take of my cat, then you know you would know about my puppy. I can't take care of a puppy. I like the low maintenance of a cat, because then the cat is just like, fuck you, I don't want to be around you all the time, which is sometimes nice. But I got the omnibus for the original edition of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
Oh, nice.
So
wow.
It's this beautiful That's little time cool. capsule of 1983 Marvel Comics, and God, I love this thing, because it is just, awesome. It's a flashback on every page.
That's very cool.
It is a neat little reminder of not only what the status quo of Marvel continuity was in 1983, but this was an amazing accomplishment, because this was the baby of Marvel editor Mark Gruenwald, who you might know as like a Captain America writer, or the guy who did Squadron Supreme. And yeah. I think back on the creation of the official Marvel handbook, which was their real attempt to make an encyclopedia of basically every Marvel character they could fit into it, every location, every piece of like technology, or every superhero team. And you get things like, oh, it's the X-Men, and there's this page that has a written history of the X-Men at that point. And then this grid with all these little headshots of all the various X-Men in the order they became X-Men, and it tells you what issue they joined the X-Men. And That's it's awesome. Super fucking exciting, because you're just like, oh my God. There were only this many X-Men in 1983, and I imagine there'd be like 12 pages of this now with just headshots. But it's wonderful. Also, things that I forgot were continuity in the past. Like, I was like, oh, okay, there's also, at the end of it, the Book of the Dead, which as a kid, oh my God, that was fascinating. Oh my God, characters have died in Marvel. And I remember, I think the 89 update was the first one I ever read, and there was an article on Norman Osborn, who miraculously was still dead in 1989. He died in the 70s in exactly the way that he died in the first Spider-Man movie, getting speared by his own goblin glider. And that image was in there of him getting, for a Bronze Age Marvel comic book, Norman Osborn's original death is still shockingly, without having any blood showing, remarkably brutal.
Yeah, it really
not
is.
Only does that, it pins him against a wall, and he's like still held up by it, and the thing's still shooting smoke out of the back of the glider, like it's pinning him there, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ. And I remember seeing that as a small kid going, oh my God, that's a bad way to die. And I was looking it up because I wanted to see if the original Human Torch was considered dead yet at that point. And I forgot that he was the Vision at that point in continuity, that yeah, at one point they yeah. decided that the Vision was rebuilt from the Human Torch. And I was like,
yep.
Oh my God, I forgot about that. And I think he had the brainwaves of Wonder Man.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think that you're right. This is really weird, because so I was talking about this with Tobiah the other day, who I think regular listeners will recognize from this program. It would have been really cool is instead I would have preferred if in Captain America the First Avengers they had had more, and they couldn't do this because of the licensing, but it would have been super cool if there had been references to the Invaders, which was Captain America, the original Human Torch, and Namor. But the Human Torch and Namor both I think belong to the Fantastic Four license, which Disney did not have at the time. or at least the film rights for them. So, but yeah, we were talking about that because of WandaVision and like all this really weird continuity where like, oh, there was an original Human Torch and he became the Vision for a while. And he did have, I do think you're right. I think he did have Wonder Man's brainwaves, whatever the hell that means. And just how funky a lot of that stuff gets, especially, I think the 80s were the last time where everything outside the X-Men was at least had some kind of continuity. And then you get to the 90s and everything just goes insane.
Oh, yeah. Everything's so big nowadays and there's so much of it that it's kind of crazy. But the other thing that really hit me is the work that Mark Gruenwald had done to compile this was in a pre-internet world and just how crazy it would be to, I mean, he'd really have to go down into the Marvel archives and dig through that like Gandalf, you know, and looking through that stuff and going, okay, I have to look for every character. Now I have to figure out what the first appearance of this character is. So, I mean, it probably means going back through comics until you don't see them anymore and figuring out, okay, what month am I in? Okay. Oh, there we go. That's where Wonder Man first appeared. And nowadays, all this stuff is on the internet, but you just didn't have that ability back then. That nobody felt the need to compile it the way that you have now, where if you have something like Wikipedia, where if you want to go, oh, where's the first time, like, Pip the Troll appeared? And, also Pip the Troll listed as dead in this. So is Thanos. And I was like, oh, I guess he was dead back then. And it was just, I love... because that's the other thing is nowadays I think that Marvel is a lot less likely to create a project like this because the internet makes the desire to create something that is always up to date kind of overwhelming, where instead what you get with the Marvel Universe handbooks or Who's Who, which is the DC equivalent, you get a time capsule. You get this idea of what... you know, Marvel Comics was doing in 1983, what these characters were like in 1983 and going, oh, okay, I guess Iceman is a member of the Defenders at this point. And, you know, I guess that's a thing. Or is he still in the Champions? I forget. There's the Champions, by the way, one of the weirdest fucking superhero teams made up of all the people no one was using. I think it was the leader was Black Widow and you had Hercules, Ghost Rider, the Angel and Iceman from the X-Men. And it's just like, why are these people a team?
It's so funny that just had that conversation about online multiplayer stuff and young kids, because right before you guys texted me, I was wrapping up a call with my friend John from LA, and we're having that same conversation. So it ran headlong into what we started talking about without me even uttering a word.
I'm kind of curious, though, Casey, now that the internet and video games are such that they are, how are you a parent in that world where there's an online thing and with the touch of a button, your kids might have to deal with a griefing racist? How do you just tell them not to play online?
I feel like I'm not at the point yet where there's even, you know, there's even online game access for my children. So, I haven't really got to that bridge yet. I think the major stuff that I have to deal with now is because the sort of temperament of my oldest is such that I have to curate his games in a way that I would never have wanted my own parents to curate my own. So when I was, 4 years old, I was just utterly obsessed with video games. But then you start off with something as just punishing and unforgiving and really a poor experience as like the Atari 2600, which, you know, my parents probably got it because the bottom had already fallen out of the home console industries. And so I'm sure they were selling used 2600s for peanuts, I'm assuming. But I mean, when you learn to play video games that are so poorly programmed and so the controls are so terrible and the difficulty is just so insanely punishing, you learn to have a thicker skin. And for my oldest kid, he doesn't have that thick of a skin. And so the types of games that he can actually enjoy playing without feeling has a profound sense of frustration are like things where they don't really have a death penalty. So anyone's probably, anyone who's sort of sampled 8-bit era games knows of this idea where the game was programmed so poorly, usually intentionally, to make it to make the experience last longer, is that you're given a set number of lives and maybe a few number of continues, and then when you use those, then you go back to the beginning of the game. Yeah. And that is so incredibly frustrating, but something that was like, well, I got nothing else to do. Of course, I'm going to restart Silver Surfer for NES again, because I rented it this weekend and I have nothing else to play. But it is not, I would never, ever, if someone asked me for a recommendation of a type of game to play, I would never be like, well, you could try Silver Surfer, because it was so frustrating of an experience and it was so poor of an experience that I just never want to play it again if I can help it. That stuff for him would just be impossible. He couldn't deal with it. He would get 30 seconds in and then would cry and wouldn't be able to deal with it. But it's like games that are like one of your favorites, I know, Joe, is the Animal Crossing New Horizons. He likes the Lego games, because the Lego games all have a death penalty that's almost insignificant. You make a mistake and your character shatters into a bunch of little Lego studs, and then you reappear in 2 seconds. So it doesn't matter. You lose some studs, but you're going to get them back anyways. Those are the types. This is kind of links up to what we were talking about before, which is like designing games such that you can make them more inclusive to other people and not just serving this one demographic of people who just like that intense online experience where they're just there to be on multiplayer, to kill other people and to be the top dog and cheating if they can and trying to get away with it. Like there's a huge movement in gaming now to include difficulty modes that include basically like a difficulty that's below easy. That's called like story, because in some cases there might be people who are just actually so turned off by the idea of an incredibly difficult mechanic that they might just want to experience the game as you're going through the story and have there being, you know, the equivalent of the little gutter balloons in the bowling alley to make it so the experience of actually doing it can be fun instead of being frustrating. And to me, I can't imagine that my oldest kid is really going to want to play competitive online games for that reason, and I guess I'm fine with that. But I'm also heartened by the fact that more developers are coming into this mode of understanding where they're like, well, wait a minute, there are going to be the games that are like the Doom Eternals of the world, where only people who are just like, yes, I want to have a heart-pounding, ridiculous experience for 35 minutes and then have to go take my beta blockers so I don't pop a coronary. People are going to love that. And then there's the other side of maybe there are people who can't do it, but they still love to have a great video game experience. And I'm happy that we have that increasingly so.
Well, it's video games have become more mainstream. And yeah. I think that not everybody is going to treat everything like the old. You mentioned this in the episode that we did on fighting games, that sort of gunslinger, I have to be the best and I'm going to take on the best sort of attitude. And then for a lot of us, one, I'm not the best. I've gotten worse at video games. I remember we played Contra, even with the Contra code, a few years ago at your house. Mm-hmm. And my God, we were dying left and right. I used to be able on that 30 lives to make it to the end of the game. I think we made it like a third of the way through the game. And that game is so punishing. And my reflexes and my memorization of how things worked had degraded so badly. It was a humbling experience. But, I mean, I don't have the... Again, maybe it was the lack of options back then. But I don't have the motivation to get that good again. I really don't. I'm more likely to go, oh, wow, that's fucking hard. And one of my favorite things in, like, L.A. Noir, mentioning that game again, was there was a level where you're just running from this guy in a bulldozer, and I was just getting killed and killed and killed. And the game finally went, you want to skip this?
Yeah.
And I said, yes,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was, otherwise, I would have poured, you know, like 10 hours into a game, and, you know, then I'm like, well, I guess I just hit a spike and now I can't finish the game. And I think the people making, you know, the game, even Rockstar, who I imagine are probably not the most woke people in the world, are like, well, we don't want people to quit our game in disgust. There's got to be a point where someone's clearly having trouble.
with something like L.A. Noire or other story-based games where the narrative is important. Like, I don't think there was ever really... Red Dead is a great, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2, I think, is a good example, is that the gameplay on that game is fine, but it's really the narrative experience that makes it something special.
Yeah.
Whereas something like, so, you know, I think games were pretty milquetoast as far as difficulty curve. You had easy, medium, and hard, and then occasionally you would have like a hardcore mode.
Yeah.
If people really wanted the challenge. And then a little game called Demon's Souls came out.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It was crushingly, painfully hard, and people loved it. And FromSoft had been making games like that for a while, but I think they do something that a lot of games, you know, it used to be when we were kids, how you made a game hard was you just threw wave after wave of enemies at people. You didn't really think about the design. You just programmed things to either be really, really reflex dependent or just have a ton of enemies.
Or make yourself supremely killable. Like that Silver Surfer game that Casey mentioned earlier is actually really bad at making you feel like the Silver Surfer who's got godlike power. Because you're about the most vulnerable thing in the universe in that game.
Look at Superman 64.
Superman 64 has its category in and of itself. Talk about failing to try to make you feel like a superhero.
Oh my god! But I think that like when I look at something like Dark Souls or Bloodborne, those games do a really good job of teaching you how to play, and you can, you know, like I would not have considered myself a great video game player, but I beat Bloodborne. And, it was difficult. It took me a really long time, but I did it. I think Control is a recent game that came out that that up until the Ultimate Edition, which just recently came out, there was not a difficulty selection.
Oh.
So you played at the base difficulty, and that game was fucking hard.
Yeah, Control is hard.
Like, there were optional bosses, like the Anchor. Fuck that Anchor.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that. Fuck the Anchor. Fuck the mold. Like, but I beat them. And, you know, a lot of times it was just kind of going, all right, well, I have the tools. Well-designed games give you the tools and punish you if you don't use them. And then you have something like Bayonetta or Devil May Cry, which I'm just like, I watch people play that game and I'm like, wow, I cannot, it's too much like a fighting game. I can't memorize the button presses that you have to do and the order in which you have to do them and the timing you have to get. I just can't do it. Like my brain doesn't work that way. But it's really interesting to me because you have so many different games that give you so many different experiences, including stuff like Stardew Valley or Animal Crossing.
Right, right.
I'm much more of a Stardew Valley fan. Kirby just looked at me and said, Joey, when the Mario stuff comes out for Animal Crossing, I think I'm going to have to redesign my island. And I'm like, for the fourth time? She's got like 800 hours in Animal Crossing.
That's amazing.
It's insane. She will, like... Audrey, my daughter, started playing. Kirby immediately started stockpiling things for her. My mom and my sister recently started playing, and my brother-in-law. And Kirby had three separate areas of her island that were just covered with things that she was going to give them when they were ready. Because she has so much shit, and she has so much money because she put so many hours into that game. And I was like, I got a 5-star island. I was like, I'm out. I'm done. I got nothing else in this game. Like, to me, that was beating the game, and it just gave me that flag, and I was like, okay, I'm done. I'll play something else now.
That's always the thing with a lot of the open-world games that we talked about a bit earlier, is that it's not an easy time to say that you're done in the same way that it is with, like, say, Super Mario World, where there's a definitive end of the game, and you have two options. You can just turn it off, or you can start again, because you did everything. The thing that I was sort of hit with is when you play a game like Red Dead Redemption, it doesn't end until you get tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we try to make a world that can do literally everything, you do eventually run out of things to do in Skyrim. You know, there's a point at which you've completed all the main plot threads. You've gotten all the things that you want. Nothing is really hard anymore. I know I've described it that way before, but there's times when you're playing Skyrim or Red Dead or any of these games, and you're like Arnold in the police station in the first Terminator, where people really can't do anything to you, and you can sort of take your time and walk around like you're a tank that has arms and legs. And, yeah. You know, usually about that point, it starts to get a little like, okay, how many side things can I can do? Do I really enjoy this stuff? Like, I sort of hit that level with Red Dead and other games, and you just sort of have to start another one. And I know that you mentioned, Joe, playing through Cyberpunk multiple times. I have never successfully been able to play through an open world game again that I play through. I've tried to play through Fallout 4. I'm like, I want to play a different kind of character. But once I start playing it, I find myself playing the comfort level game that I usually do with a certain kind of things. And then I'm like, okay, I want to try playing Skyrim again. But I end up slowly creating, despite where I start, the same kind of character that I played the first time. And I get bored with it and I quit. So I guess I only have one of those things to, I play it exhaustively, but once I'm done with it, I'm kind of done with it.
I find that with games like, so I played Dragon Age again. It was the third time I had played it through to the end. And I played as a character, like I'll play through to romance different characters because I think that's fun. It's a fun part for me, you know, and I'm a romantic at heart for all my bluster and blather. And so, you know, the first time I played, I romanced one person, and then I played it again pretty quickly, and I romanced another person who's probably my favorite character in the series. And then in Dragon Age Inquisition, there's an elf you recruit who is basically an Antifa leftist. She's basically like, fuck rich people. They only step on poor people. Let's kick their asses. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm with you. And so I romanced her this time because it felt right. But I think that, you know, that games like that, I will replay for that because I find that kind of stuff interesting. And I think that if those things are written right, you can get some very sweet, very good, very well-written moments out of it. And that's basically what I did with Cyberpunk as well. But Cyberpunk, like I don't know that I've ever had the experience where I finished that. So I got to the point of no return. I played for another 20 hours, not doing it. Finally just did it. And then played around a little bit with some of the end game loot. Cause it gives you some end game loot and then puts you back for it autosaves before the point of no return.
So that's nice.
Play around in that world a little bit more.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is very cool. And then I immediately started another character and played through and romanced the other character. And I had both times were such good experiences. In the second one, I got to do some of the things I didn't get a chance to do in the first one, and I made different. I actually forced myself to make different choices. But what's really interesting to me is that that had never really happened before. Like I played that game probably 60 to 70 hours a pop back to back at the exclusion of all else. And I could have played it a third time.
Wow.
And I don't know if it's just, I was a big Cyberpunk 2020 fan. It was one of the first tabletop RPGs I played. And I just think that I really was hungry for that world. And at this point, I've played a majority of the endings. I have one life path left to play, and that'll be my last one, or at least the next one I do when it comes. I'm going to do it when it comes out on PS5, which I'm assuming will be the fall.
Right.
But I think that, you know, some games have, like, I keep going back to say, I keep telling myself I'm going to replay Red Dead Redemption 2 because I really love that game. But honestly, the thought of how that game ends, and just like, and not to spoil anything, so this is my indication that if you haven't played it and you want to, you should stop listening to what I'm about to say. The ending of that game was so, both endings of that game, because you have the ending of the main story and the ending of the epilogue, are both so emotionally fraught that it's hard. It's hard. Yeah. There were moments in that game where I, like, there was a cutscene and I put the controller down and the cutscene would end and I'd realize 5 minutes, I was fucking stunned. It was like I had just watched a scene from a movie. And I think that it really did something from Rockstar, which made State of Emergency, which was a game where you could, like, punch people until their limbs fell off and then use their limbs to beat up other people. Right? Like, this really incredibly written game that was driving towards all these really nuanced points about authority and loyalty and friendship and family, and also making a statement about how that time period and how it was moving on and innovation was inherently changing the face of the West. Like, I feel like that game does not participate in a lot of, you know, Westerns are one of these genres that our country was really built on, and they're largely bullshit up until you get into the 70s when you start getting the more revisionist history stuff, where it was like, oh no, Manifest Destiny was all bullshit. It was all butchering people that had been there already and, you know, humping the land into being ours, and it was a lot of bullshit and garbage, and it was not this romantic time that we imagine it to be, because that's what we've been told. And, like, that was really impressive to me. But I even though I keep telling myself I'm going to play it again, I don't know that I can.
Well, a lot of it, too, is it's an emotional journey, and you went through that journey, and am I going to make different choices now? I mean, that's the thing, is that it felt like getting that ending that I got was this earned experience made through the summation of all these different choices. And a lot of times the reason a lot of people want to play games again is to make different choices, but I don't want to make different choices because those ones make you an asshole. I tried to make Arthur Morgan as good of a guy, as remorseful a guy as I could. And the good guy ending is a lot more emotionally resonant with me. And I look at like bad ones and it's not as good. And I can watch that online if I need to. And, it's the fact that all of these things are part of this one big emotional experience that I went through that emotional experience. And I don't know, I mean, I participated in that emotional experience and I don't know what that would be like again. And if it would be nearly as, it feels like it would be just a series of choices and outcomes rather than a coherent emotional through line, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think of it in the same way as I think of something like, I remember the first Buñuel film I watched was this movie called Los Olvidados, which is a movie I am glad I watched. It makes a very powerful statement, and I don't know that I will ever watch it again because it really fucked me up pretty bad. And I think that some things are like that. Some things you can experience one and be like, I'm full, I'm good, I don't ever need to do that again. And some things you can keep going back to, you know, some things are oysters on the half shell, and some things are macaroni and cheese. And some people really like oysters on the half shell, but I've tried one once and that was good enough for me. I don't really need to do it again. But I would eat macaroni and cheese forever. So, I think that it's really cool that video games are finally getting to the point where you can have something like Red Dead Redemption 2, or you can have these really big like Cyberpunk 2077, but you can also have Firewatch.
Yeah.
Which is just this very intimate story about two people and the choices we make, or like Night in the Woods, which is a fantastic story about the things that people do to keep small towns alive and going back home after trying to leave your small town. And just there are so many different experiences that they provide now, And when I was a kid, you had Battletoads. You know, you had the Clash of Demon Head, which is a garbage game that gives you no indication as to what to do or where to go or how to beat it past a certain point.
And we can just mention also that Battletoads, nobody ever gets past the jet ski level. And therefore, there's really only three playable levels of Battletoads that anyone has ever played.
So I will say this. If you are a video game person, if you're a video game head like myself, you should go onto YouTube and you should look up a guy. His name is The Mexican Runner.
Oh, I love that guy so much.
He's fucking incredible. He runs that level blindfolded.
Yeah, The Mexican Runner is amazing, Mike, and I don't know if you've heard about him. Part of his, he's like us. He's kind of funded by Patreon people because he's a known quantity in the sort of speedrunning community. He also embarked on, and I don't know, I think it took him almost 2 years. He did a thing where he would sequentially play to the whatever endpoint could be had every single SNES game released in North America.
Jesus.
And this included the one that was sold with the piano keyboard. So in one of the sessions that took him days, weeks, I think, he had to actually learn how to play piano so he could actually win the game. It's insane dedication.
But he played the ones that he had to team up with the little robot guy.
Oh, I'm sure. You
they only made like two of those.
I think you can play them without Rob the Robot. I think you can.
I think you can, too. You just have to have a friend there who can stack those blocks a lot faster than that stupid robot can.
Yeah.
You can just get a human. It's the ultimate John Henry test.
But yeah, he does Cuphead, which is another game that I love where difficulty is kind of the point. And he does, which is, I highly recommend his run on that, but I watch his Battletoads run because it's insane. And he did the blindfolded, that blindfolded jet ski level live.
Oh, that fucking jet ski level.
That game.
There are three levels of Battletoads, if you don't know. There's the first level, which is a lot of fun. There's the second level, which can be very frustrating if you're playing it two-player, because you can knock each other down the pit, especially if you turn into the really satisfying wrecking ball, which is a really cool attack, but you will kill your friend and get angry at each other, so you almost have to like team up and intentionally nerf yourself so you don't constantly kill each other. And then there's a jet ski level that you die at, and that's the whole game.
Mike's experience has been so diminutive, Mike. There's a whole world of Battletoads you haven't seen.
Oh my god!
But there is something that's true. There is an end of the game that you can complete. However, the game is obviously notoriously difficult, and even more difficult with two players for this reason you describe, which is like you both have to be doing well enough to finish the game, because those levels where it's just an auto-scroller and it's just pushing you forward, you have to commit. They clearly didn't play test this game to the end, because there is a level where you're sort of trapped inside of like a box and you have... they look kind of like motorcycles, but unicycle motorcycles. There's a big colorful wheel and you're on a handlebar and you're riding it sort of up, down, left and right. And you're trying to be outrun by like a Indiana Jones giant rolly ball that's going to crush you. You've got to outrun those two. It's actually not possible for two players to beat that game together because of a bug somewhere that hangs up player two. So it is possible for the second player to just die before that level and then come back and join in again after that level. But it is actually impossible with the game's their ship code for two players to play the game from beginning to end. It was so hard. It was so difficult that they couldn't have two people play test the two player mode from beginning to end.
Son of a bitch.
Also, I think the average speed run time for completion on that game is something like 30 minutes, which blows my mind.
That's a long time. That's a long time for a Twitch heavy old, unforgiving like 8-bit game. 30 minutes is punishing.
And, yeah.
30 minutes is about the average time I have before I rage quit the jet ski level.
That's totally, totally fair. That's totally fair. But I, yeah, it's really, it's crazy to me that people that were like, oh, I really liked that experience, but I can polish it, and then made games like Celeste or things like Cuphead, where it's very fiendishly difficult, but it's fair. It's not just bullshit. And when you beat a level, you feel something like, oh God, I just did this. And I really appreciate that about games. You know, I always give my parents a hard time. I was watching on YouTube the other day the North American qualifiers for Mortal Kombat 11 were happening.
Whoa.
And I love,
are they
if,
up,
you, if you've never
they're up to
seen
11?
A fighting game tournament. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. And if you've never seen a fighting game tournament before, I highly recommend them if you have any interest at all, because they are very fun. A lot of times they come down to the wire. It's just a really interesting display of skill. But I, you know, I always give my parents a hard time because I'm like, see, you told me I couldn't make a living doing this shit, and I could have. If you just let me play more video games, I could be a famous Twitch streamer right now. And I blame you for the fact that I'm not.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Joe, but...
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just a dollar a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Now going into the turbo tunnel to actually see the blindfolded. And of course, when we say blindfolded, we mean the fun part that no one gets past as a kid, except TMR, who's God Gamer.
I was stubborn, man. I didn't want it to lose.
I know.